Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. Our special guest this evening is Peter Lance. He's written a wonderful book. It's called 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story. And this really is the untold story. I've got probably 40 or 50 books on 9/11 and what led up to that. But this is the most intriguing book because it gives you so much of the background of the first World Trade Center bombing, the attack on Rabbi Kahana after that, the planned bombing there in New York where they were going to take out the Holland Tunnel and the Brooklyn Bridge, and you begin to know all of these characters and then the various people that were involved in that bombing plot and the mastermind behind it, Ramzi Yosef. And then, of course, as you get into it more and more, you realize that the FBI had known from a long time that there were going to be attacks, and they did nothing about it. They'd been warned about the first attack on the World Trade Center. They had a man deeply involved with the terrorist cell, and they drove him away. I mean, it's the most incredible story. Mr. Lance, as you have developed this story, didn't you sometimes get that feeling of frustration? How could anybody be this stupid unintentionally?
Yeah, anger was the word that kept cropping up. I mean, I first of all, bewilderment, because, you know, Hollywood has created this kind of myth of the invincible FBI, the G-man that always gets his man. And my experience in doing this story was that there were levels of incompetence in the beginning of the story. It's a 12-year story, as you say, leading up to 9/11. But in the beginning, it was incompetence mixed with arrogance, the idea that these were ragheads, as they would call them pejoratively, these men who sought such villainy on our country. And yet, over the years, I think ultimately there was cover-up involved because people did start connecting the dots, and they had to cover for the fact that they essentially, what I'm saying in this book, Doctor, is they could have prevented 9/11. It's not 20/20 hindsight, because the original World Trade Center bomber kept his date with those towers a second time, and he put that plot in motion in 1995 in the Philippines, and the FBI was informed fully of the plot in 1995. When they then realized that, oh my gosh, we could have stopped this man in 1992 prior to the first bombing, I think they moved into the cover-up mode. So it began with arrogance and incompetence, and then it became, I believe, a cover-up.
Well, if you get into the background, this cover-up of Operation Bajinka, or the plot that went right along with that, and I'm going to let you tell the story let's start at the very beginning, because we're only going to have an hour, and it's getting pretty late back there where you are, back in the East Coast, and are you still working there for preparation for your next book?
Yes, in fact, I wanted to tell you, I had the most remarkable day today. I spent my morning with five of the courageous widows from the 9/11 Family Steering Committee. These women are making our democracy work. These are the wives of, the day before 9/11, they were the modest conservative wives of stockbrokers. Today, they have become almost radicalized about the failures in the system. And they are the women who are organized and pushing the 9/11 Commission to get at the truth. It's almost like, I had this thought tonight on the eve of the 40th anniversary of the slaying of John F. Kennedy. If Jackie Kennedy had personally pushed the Warren Commission to tell the truth and fully disclose the truth around the death of her husband, we might not have had all these conspiracy theorists over the years. You know, people would have trusted the Warren Commission. Well, the 9/11 Commission is the Warren Commission of our day. And at this moment, it's very doubtful that they're going to get to the truth, in part because they have a deadline imposed by Congress at the end of May, and they only have a $14 million budget. And compare that to the $50 million for the Columbia space shuttle investigation, where eight people died. So the commissioners now are literally making compromises with the White House to get information and pretty much saying, well, we're under tremendous time pressure, so we're just going to take what we can get. Well, why even have a deadline? Why not make this open-ended till they get to the truth? So that's what these women are saying. They're pushing and pushing these commissioners to get to the truth. And it was a thrill to be with them. And that's who I'm doing my next book about. I'm doing my next book about these women and the day of, essentially. Because this current book, A Thousand Years for Revenge, takes us up to the 9/11. This new book is going to be called, it's going to be about the day of and beyond. And it's really going to celebrate the work of these women.
Is that Kristen Breitweiser and Mindy Kleinberg?
Right, Kristen Breitweiser, Lori Van Auken, Patty Kazaza, Mindy Kleinberg, Monica Gabriel. I did a program yesterday on a broadcast called Democracy Now with Monica Gabriel. Monica is the head of what they call the Skyscraper Safety Campaign, and one of her areas of expertise is the question of why the towers fell in 102 minutes. They were designed to stand for 4 hours, doctor, even after being hit by Boeing 707s, which is the biggest plane of the day when they were built, yet they went down in 102 minutes because of faulty building construction and a number of other things. And Monica's whole thing is, why did they go down and what can we learn from that? So every one of these women has a different area of expertise, and they've all been kind of on-the-job training. You know, they've learned, and they've studied, and they're pushing these commissioners to get to the truth. So I'm literally walking through the noise in the background as I'm walking through the streets of New York right now, and doing my research, you know.
Are any of the women willing to do any radio programs? I asked you before. I don't.
Oh, absolutely! I want to get them. I told them I was going to be on with you tonight, and they would love to get on with you. See, one of the things that has happened is this week, the White House, or last week, reached a deal with the 9/11 Commission, where instead of turning over all the PDBs, the Presidential Daily Briefings, which are the intelligence reports, which could shed light on how much prior knowledge this administration had, they made a deal to, instead of, and the, all these commissioners have the proper security clearance, so they wouldn't have been appointed, but instead of the 10 commissioners, 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, looking at these presidential daily briefings, they're going to send 2 people over to the White House, metaphorically speaking, to, you know, the White House, to wherever the repository of this information is. They're going to look at them, then they're going to write up a report, which they're then going to share with the other, for 4 people on the commission. Then they're going to bring that report back after the White House has kind of edited it and share that with the 10 commissioners. Now, women are saying this is crazy. I mean, what's wrong with showing the presidential daily briefings? We're not talking about releasing it to the American public. We're talking about showing the 10 commissioners who have been appointed, you know, by the president in order to get to the truth behind 9/11. And the key to this is the following. It's when John Kennedy died, as tragic as that murder was, it didn't affect national security. You know, it was the tragic death of a president. The attacks of 9/11 go directly to our security and the failure of the intelligence agencies to predict and stop 9/11. If we don't get to the truth behind how it happened, how are we going to protect ourselves the next time? And every single politician is now saying that it's inevitable that we're going to be hit again. So, you know, these women are, you know, pushing for, the truth, full disclosure.
Well, I think that if there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing it? And I think that if the American people knew really what led up to 9/11, why there would be literally a revolt in this country. But now our boys are overseas dying, and, well, they're dying in Afghanistan, they're dying in Iraq, because of what happened on 9/11. And if it was known that the government knew that it was going to be something and did nothing to stop it, think of the implications. And I think that the current investigation is a phony. I mean, the president insisted on being able to appoint the people who are going to investigate the president. Right. I mean, what sort of logic is that, and why are the American people accepting it? And I'm so glad that the women are back there. At least they have the courage to do what's right rather than simply go along like most people are. They don't want to be involved. Well, we're all involved in this. But let's get to your book, because I think this is so vitally important, and I'm glad you're going to write this book with the 5 wives, and I hope that we can get them onto our programs, because I certainly published both Mindy Kleinberg's and Kristen Breitweiser's testimony because,
right.
well, the media just totally ignored it. Oh, you can right. get it off the internet, but the average individual has never heard what right. these two women wrote. Well, let's get back to a man named Ramzi Yosef, who is really the key villain in this. He was responsible right. for the first World Trade Center bombing. He was responsible for the 9/11 attack, even though he was in prison at the time.
Right.
And the frightening thing about this is he'd laid the whole plan out in 1995. The government had right. the plan, and right. now they're covering for it. And they have done everything they can to keep the American people from knowing that they knew about
right.
the plan, the hijacked planes and crash them into the World Trade Center. So why don't you yeah. tell the story of Ramzi Yosef, who he is, how this yeah. whole thing, incredible story, fits together.
Okay. The title of my book, 1,000 Years for Revenge, comes from an expression in Baluchistan. And Baluchistan is the ethnic province from which Ramzi Yosef hails. And even though he was essentially born there but raised in Kuwait, his father moved to Kuwait to work in the oil industry, Yosef is a Baluchistani. And they have an expression, if it takes me 10 centuries to kill my enemy, I will wait 1,000 years for revenge. This ultimate struggle that we're faced with, this threat to our national security, has to do with it goes back to the Crusades. It goes back to the 11th century when the Knight Templars of Malta came down and sacked the castles of the Islamic princes. And in those days, and there's an irony here because of the fire service, I don't know if you and I have talked about this, but the Maltese cross, which is the symbol, the universal symbol of firefighting worldwide, when you see a firefighter and they all have those blue shirts on and they have their engine companies over their breast, they all have Maltese crosses. And the Maltese cross was associated with the fire service because when the Knight Templars from Malta were storming the castles and during the Crusades in the Middle East, the Islamics were pouring naphtha, burning naphtha, which is kind of like a precursor to napalm or Sterno, down on them, and the first organized fire brigades in world history were the Knights of Malta. So forever since then, the Maltese Cross has been associated worldwide with firefighting. And ironically, 1,000 years after those attacks, as Ronnie Buka, one of the heroes of my book, pointed out one night, he said, "We took their castles and now they're coming back to take ours." And I know that I'm speaking metaphorically as he was, but the truth is the hatred that is at the bottom of this worldwide jihad that bin Laden is at the front of, that hatred goes back 1,000 years, and I think Americans have to understand that. Ramzi Yosef came from this province and was educated in Swansea Institute in Wales and became an engineer and went around 1989 or 90, as best we know, to Afghanistan. And at the time, as you know, there was a good war going on, a war that we supported, the war against the Soviets by the Mujahideen rebels, the Afghani rebels. And those Afghan rebels were joined by thousands, tens of thousands of what they called Afghan Arabs. And Afghan Arabs were Islamics from around the world, black South Africans, blue Chechens, blue-eyed Chechens, Filipinos, you know, Islamics from all over the world. Their version of the Spanish Civil War. They were united in this effort to get rid of the Soviets, and we supported them to the tune of $3 billion that went through the CIA, and the Saudis reportedly matched it dollar for dollar, including giving them 500 Stinger missiles, et cetera, et cetera.
But, of course, we were actually indoctrinating them in this whole radical form of Islam, which had been pretty well, quiescent for 100 years or 50 years. And, you know, but we were trying to tell them, Allah's with you, and at least
right.
my impression is that we were once again rekindling this spark of ancient Islam that had really been lying quiescent for some time with this
right.
idea that Allah was going to give them the victory as
right.
they killed the infidels.
Right. It's one of the reasons Islamic, the sense of Allah has written the date of your death, and it's predetermined, is one of the reasons throughout history Islamic fighters have always been so fierce, because they don't go into battle with the same fear of death that a Western soldier might, because they know, or they have a sense of their destiny has already been prescribed or proscribed ahead of time. So the bottom line is that you're right, and we whipped them into this frenzy for strategic foreign policy purposes, and I think it was, it was one of the death knells of the evil empire. I mean, the communism went down. It was the Vietnam, if you will, of the Soviet Union. However, instead of focusing on that theory of operations and realizing that, in fact, we'd invested so much money there, we ignored it. We turned our back on it. And these men, and Bin Laden in particular, decided to take this worldwide fundraising network that had been created called the MAK, the Office of Services for the Mujahideen, they called it, and there was a brick-and-mortar network of storefronts, if you will, around the world, many in Europe, one in Brooklyn in particular, one in Detroit, one in Pittsburgh, a big one in Tucson, and these brick-and-mortar outposts were raising millions and millions in cash every year for the Mujahideen. Well, in 1989, when the Soviets were dispatched, the man, Abdullah Azzam, a Palestinian scholar who presided over and created the network, wanted to take those millions that were still pouring in and use them to set up a Taliban-like government in Afghanistan. But he had a falling out with Bin Laden. And not just Bin Laden. And this is the key to the story. Blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, a radical cleric who is an Egyptian, with Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, another Egyptian, and Mohammed Atef, a third Egyptian. These three men sided with Bin Laden, and a coup d'etat happened. It's like a mob takeover. And Azzam was mysteriously murdered in November of 1989 in a car bombing with his two sons. And even though Bin Laden professed grief, many intelligence people believe that he was responsible. Right away, he inherited that network, a brick-and-mortar outpost, and morphed it into Al-Qaeda. And he wanted the money for the worldwide jihad. And the reason the Egyptians supported him is they wanted to use the money to overthrow President Mubarak in Egypt. So what you had is... Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things that bothers me is that Ramzi Youssef was a master bomb builder. In other words, he was one of the greatest bomb builders of the whole world. My understanding, and I know that when they opened the trial for the people who bombed the World Trade Center, the prosecutor opened the trial by saying that Youssef and one of the other people, what his name is, I never can remember the fellow who came into the country with him, had been trained in 1989.
Had been trained in
1979 in a terrorist training camp in building bombs there. Have you ever heard anything at all about that?
They were trained in one of Bin Laden's camps along the Afghan-Pakistani border.
In
1989, effectively. Right at the same time I'm talking about, that's where Ramzi left Swansea Institute and went there, and that's where he picked up his practical bomb building experience.
But he was a master bomb builder. He could build bombs of any sort. I mean, here's a man who had a talent that could destroy the world had it not been stopped.
Well, if you believe in the great person theory of history, as I do, that, and I say great person as opposed to great men, because we know there are great women that have shaped history, the fatal combination of Osama bin Laden, this billionaire with international capabilities, Ramzi Youssef, this technical genius, and Blind Sheikh Rahman, who was essentially the spiritual pope of these men. That was a fatal trio, the three of these guys coming together. And so you had essentially Youssef for 4 years, ultimately became the point man of Al-Qaeda. He became the chief bomb maker. And doctor, one of the things that was so extraordinary about Ramzi, and he is a true villain, he's the villain of my book, but you almost, and I don't want to say this in a way that could be misconstrued, you had to admire the guy. It was almost tragic that he wasn't on our side. It was tragic that he wasn't on our side as opposed to the enemy. But he went from building weapons of mass destruction to be delivered to a site in a truck. That is to say, the World Trade Center bomb, the bomb that attempted to blow up the Israeli embassy in Bangkok. And I think in my book, I make a pretty good case that he inspired Terry Nichols and McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing. He went from building bombs like that to conceiving a tiny, undetectable bomb trigger that would be smuggled on board a plane, a jumbo jet that was going to be on a two-leg hop. It was going to, let's say, leave Hong Kong, go to Malaysia. On the first leg of the flight, they would get on board, build with these components, build a bomb, plant it above the fuel tank, and get off, and the plane would blow later on.
That's a rather
ingenious approach.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Peter Lance, his book, 1,000 Years for Revenge. Great, great, great book. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon or this evening is Peter Lance's 1,000 Years for Revenge. And basically, Peter's been saying how Ramzi Yosef could build these bombs, and he'd even tried one, and it did work, that they could build it in the laboratory there aboard the plane, slip it under the seat, and of course the plan was then to put that in an area where it would explode the central fuel tank and take the planes down, and they planned to take down 10 or 12 American planes almost simultaneously as they were flying across the ocean. What did that have anything to do with the Iranians' effort to get revenge on America for having taken down their plane, their passenger plane, accidentally, or was this completely separate?
Well, the Vincennes, if you remember, was the Aegis cruiser that shot down the Iranian airliner. And I believe in my research, and it predated my research for this book, that Pan Am 103 was the consequence of that action. That in fact the Iranians, believe it or not, went to Libya and recruited Gaddafi, whose two agents essentially planted the bomb in a Toshiba boombox aboard Pan Am 103 in luggage. So I think it's fair to say that clearly there's always a cause and effect in the war on terror, and I believe that Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie was the consequence of the Vincennes shooting down that plane.
All right. Well, now, of course, Sheikh Omar Rahman was brought to the United States with the help of the CIA. This is one of the most incredible things. He was in and out of jail in Egypt, associated with the murder, the assassination of Anwar Sadat. And then it seems he'd get in jail and the CIA would somehow get him out. And then they arranged for a visa for Rahman to come to the United States. Why would they do anything that stupid unintentionally?
Well, you know, there are two schools of thought. One school of thought is that it was payback for his help with the Mujahideen, and they just didn't get how dangerous this guy was. Okay, that's one school of thought. The other school of thought gives them too much credit, and that is that they wanted him where they could watch him. But that's absurd, because my book documents that they didn't watch him. And in fact, when he got here, within months, there was the murder of Rabbi Meir Kahane by one of his followers, El Sayed Nasser, another Egyptian. And then a few months later, there was the murder of Mustafa Shalabi, another Egyptian, who was brutally slain. And that, on February 27th, 91, was the takeover of the MAK outlet in Brooklyn that became an Al-Qaeda outpost. So within months of being here, there were two grisly homicides in New York City associated with the Blind Sheikh. And then, of course, within a year and a half, there was the World Trade Center bombing, and he was at the heart of the plot.
But, you know, the incredible thing is the gentleman who sought the Kahane, who was, of course, the leader of the Jewish Defense League, he gets captured. The FBI go to his home, and who was there but some fellow named Abu Halima, who they known as Red, great big, tall, red-headed Egyptian, and one other fellow. Now, these were the people who were involved in the World Trade Center bombing. They're at the home of the fellow who's obviously part of some sort of a terrorist plot. They killed Kahane, and there's some 46 boxes of records there. They're all in Arabic. And what do they do? Right, they let Abu Halima go. They just forget to translate all these records, which is their first insight into this terrorist cell, and they do absolutely nothing about it.
Right. In fact, it was the first true evidence of an international conspiracy, but it was their second date with these guys, because if you recall, at the timeline I have in my book, and I encourage people, if you don't mind me saying so, I have a website, which is peterlance.com, my name. On the website, you can see pictures of these guys that were taken
covered
in Long Island.
Hold that thought. Right, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Peter Lance's book, 1,000 Years for Revenge. And Peter was just talking about the fact that he has a timeline in his book. You want to read it because he actually gives you the background of everything that happened, going back to the fact that this terrorist cell that was operating in New York City under the direction or under the tutelage of a man named Sheikh Omar Rahman, who had been allowed to come to this country. In fact, the CIA had made arrangements for this man to come in, get a visa for him, despite the fact that he's a known terrorist. He's been arrested over there in Egypt as a terrorist. He's pushing this whole Islamic terrorist movement. So what do we do? Why do we bring him here to the United States? He sets up the terrorist movement here. And the FBI had actually been following, I think, several years previously, the fact that these Islamic people, this is even before Rockman comes, are going up on the range and shooting on Sundays, and they're doing, they got pictures of them up on the range shooting, and they do absolutely nothing about it. What madness is that?
Four weekends in a row in July of 1989. Now, this is 1989, 12 years before 9/11. On four weekends, the Special Operations Group of the Bureau, which is the black bag unit that got Gotti, it's their elite surveillance unit, follows this group of MEs, which is Middle Eastern men in bureau speak, to this Calvert and Long Island range. And of those men that they found shooting, three of them went on to bomb the Trade Center. That was Mahmoud Abu Lima, the big red-headed Egyptian, Mohammed Salema, a little Palestinian, Nidal Ayad, okay, a Rutgers grad. Those three of them went on to bomb the Trade Center. El Sayed Nasser, an Egyptian, went on to kill Rabbi Meir Kahane in 1990, November 5th. Two of them went on to plot to blow up the bridges and tunnels around Manhattan with the Blind Sheikh. And one of them, their leader, Ali Mohammed, went on to train bin Laden's bodyguards in Afghanistan. And he then went on to scout the African embassies. 9 years later, 234 dead, 5,000 injured. He took the pictures and bin Laden pointed to where he wanted the trucks at the bomb. They were on the radar screen of the FBI in 1989. And as you mentioned a while ago, the second incident was the death of Kahane. The third incident was when Nancy Floyd, this courageous FBI agent, recruited an asset, an Egyptian ex-army officer named Salem, who risked his life, went undercover for $500 a week, infiltrated the Sheikh's cell, discovered a bombing conspiracy, and went to her and said, "We got to do something. You're the FBI now. Let's start doing surveillance." And she said, "Great." And she went to her boss, and then a new head of terrorism, a guy named Carson Dunbar, came in, who was like a desk jockey. He was appointed the head of terrorism in New York, and he had no terrorism experience. He didn't trust her. He didn't like Salem, and he basically made the guy re-audition for the part after he'd been risking his life for months, demanded he take a polygraph, demanded that he wear a wire, which is not how they recruited him, and Salem withdrew. The last thing he said to Nancy Floyd in the summer of the fall of 92, by now Ramzi Youssef had entered the country, he's building a bomb. Now, Salem didn't know specifically who he was, but he knew there was a bomb being, some conspiracy was afoot. He begged her, "Nancy, please, you're the FBI, follow these guys, follow Salema, the redhead, Mahmoud Abu Lima, follow Salema. They will lead you to what's going on. If you do not do this, Nancy, don't call me when the bombs, plural, go off." That's what he said, the last thing he said. The day after the bombing, doctor, and by the way, Abu Lima and Salema with Youssef 24/7, helping him build the bomb. The day after the bombing, and they'd already been in the custody of the NYPD once, they'd been under surveillance since 1989, they had even searched Abu Lima's apartment at one point, they had probable cause to get a warrant to search his apartment. And now, the day after the bombing, they frantically bring this guy, Salem, back under, and they pay him $1.5 million to do what he could have done in the fall of 92. He sets up a sting operation. In 2 months, he rounds up the Blind Sheikh and the entire crew for the bridge and tunnel plot, and he got $1.5 million for doing what he could have done for $500 a week prior to the bombing, and basically became the linchpin witness for the government. Now, if they had done that, because I proved that Youssef is the architect of 9/11, they would have stopped 9/11, because Ramzi Youssef was the guy, the genius, that conceived of this plot to fly jetliners in the building. And there's not a question in my mind that if they had done their job in 92, they would have stopped 9/11.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And the tragedy was that you point out in your book that here's a Salem, and he is he's an Egyptian military officer, been a major, and always used to a very proud individual. The FBI demands he comes into there, risking his life because he's working undercover. If anybody saw him going in, why, he'd be exposed and they'd kill him. And he goes in to see the FBI. He said, "What is he doing?" He's sitting cross-legged on the couch with his shoes off. Totally disrespectful to this man who's risked his life for our government and for our country. It's an incredible, incredible story. Yeah. And, you know, as you read it, if your blood pressure is low, why, this will get it back up again. Anyway, hang on there. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that we're going to be having a conference a week from tomorrow at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. This is on Saturday, the 29th of November, 2 days after Thanksgiving. A terrible weekend, but it was the only weekend we could get the location, and we wanted to have another seminar this year because the last year's seminar was so successful. Under any circumstances, we're going to have Joan Paris, who's going to tell you what's really in the USA Patriot Act, because everybody who talks about the USA Patriot Act has not read it, and Joan has done a tremendous job. You really enjoy her remarks. You'll enjoy Dr. Robert Klink as he tells you what's happening to the Christian churches across America as thousands of them begin to change their message and their music to become more popular. It's sort of fit in with society and bringing marketing techniques developed for selling soap or for selling products into the Christian church so we can market Christianity and get a lot more people in. We're not going to get any more Christians, but we're going to get a lot of people filling those churches. You'll be fascinated by the information Dr. Klink has accumulated because you really can't understand anything going on today unless you understand the true origin of what's known as the church growth movement. Bill Sardi will be there, and he'll be talking about some exciting new advances as far as health is concerned. Brad Dacus will be there talking about what's happening as far as Christian persecution. I'll be talking about why we are really in Iraq, and also why the Supreme Court has taken God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools. An entirely different approach than you're going to hear before. Why Sandra Day O'Connor and Justice Kennedy vote the way they do. Why Judge John Paul Stevens seems to be always on the wrong side. So this should, I hope, will be a very, very interesting program. There's going to be an hour panel. There's going to be lunch served. If you're going to come, you're going to have to let us know this weekend, because we have to know by Monday how many people are going to be there. And its program is going to start at 8:30 in the morning, go through till 5 in the evening. There's going to be doors will be open probably at 7:45 in the morning. Get there early. You don't want to miss the first program because nobody wanted to be the first speaker, so the staff decided that I would be the first speaker. But you won't want to miss this talk. It will give you a real insight into what Iraq is really all about. American boys are dying there. Iraqis are dying there. Women and children are dying there. It's a tragic situation. And are we really going to catch Osama bin Laden and his band of wicked terrorists by attacking Iraq and replacing Saddam Hussein? Well, we'll look forward to seeing you. Give us a call tonight. And this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Peter Lance. Those of you who wanted to give us a call as far as coming to the conference, remember our number. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, Mr. Lance was talking about Ramzi Yosef, the master bomb builder who actually built the bomb that was to take down the World Trade Center, and the bomb went off then in February of 1993. And he was able to escape. He actually left the other people here. One other person escaped to Iraq. Ramzi Yosef went off. Where did Ramzi Yosef go immediately after the attack, do you recall?
He went to Pakistan, and he tried to twice to kill Benazir Bhutto, the female about to be prime minister of Pakistan. He reportedly set off a bomb in a Shiite mosque. He's a Sunni Muslim. He reportedly killed 25 people in Iran. He then reportedly tried to do a truck bomb that would blow up the Israeli embassy in Bangkok. I mean, this guy was, no James Bond villain could equal Ramzi Yosef, in terms of his energy and his audacity and his ingenuity. Yep. And he finally found his way to the Philippines, where he had already been in the early 90s training the Abu Sayyaf. The Abu Sayyaf is one of the al-Qaeda surrogates, if you will, in the Philippines. And we found in our book that they were funded directly through Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law, Muhammad Jamal Khalifa, direct connection to him. And so Yusuf went back there with his uncle Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, his oldest friend Abdul Hakim Murad, and a fourth individual called Wali Khan Amin Shah, who is an Uzbeki, who is beloved of bin Laden. Bin Laden called him the Lion for his work in Afghanistan. And the four of them had a cell at the Donna Josepha Apartments on General Carino Boulevard in Manila, that was not too far from where the Pope was going to be staying, the Papal Nuncio's residence. The Pope was going to be there on the 12th of January, moved in the fall of 94, and they hatched what we now know to be three plots. One plot to blow up the Pope along his parade route with a series of remote-controlled pipe bombs. Second plot, this Bojinka plot we discussed, which was a plot to blow up 11 U.S. jumbo jets incoming to the U.S., and Ramzi, as you had alluded to earlier, did a test bomb, what he called a wet test, on a Philippine Airlines Flight 434, a 747-100 that took off on December 11, 94, bound for Cebu in the southern Philippines, on to Narita in Japan. And on the first leg, he smuggled these bomb components on board, put them together into this bomb trigger, an ingenious device driven by a Casio watch, and put the contents in a life jacket pouch below seat 26K, thinking it would be right over the center fuel tank, and when the bomb blew, the plane would blow. Well, he miscalculated by a row, and the individual in the seat was killed instantly, cut in half, in fact, but the plane landed, was managed to land. But Yusuf knew now that this could work, so his plot was to blow up almost a dozen planes using, he would plant three, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would plant three, Wali Khan three, and Abdul Hakim Murad would plant two or three. They basically, these planes would have U.S. tourists coming in from Asia, and they would plant the bombs on the first leg of a two-leg hop. 4,000 people would have died ultimately. That what the feds alleged, by the way, doctor, in what they call the day of the 48 hours of terror, they called it, was that the planes would blow up over the Pacific. But in fact, what I found in my book was that the Casio watches could be sent months in advance, and that they actually planned a much more monstrous scenario, wherein the planes would blow, some over the ocean, some as they flew into U.S. cities, some sitting next to terminals and airports. I mean, imagine if over the next 9 months, these 11 planes blew. No one would know when they were going to blow. Worldwide air travel would be ground to a halt. And it would have actually made 9/11 look like a modest plot in comparison. But they had a fire in their apartment in Manila, in this Donna Josepha. And Yusuf fled with Khalid Sheikh to Islamabad, where he was captured a month later. Khalid Sheikh escaped. And in my book, I point out that even though the FBI grabbed Yusuf in this 20-room guest house and Pakistan, controlled by bin Laden, they let Khalid Sheikh go. He was on the ground floor. He even gave an interview to Time magazine using his own name. How audacious can you get? And they missed him only to go on to execute his nephew Yusuf's plot. And I proved for the first time that there were 10 men training in U.S. flight schools in 94. There were 6 targets, including the Trade Center, the Pentagon, Transamerica Tower in San Francisco, the Sears Tower in Chicago, a nuclear facility, CIA headquarters, and that the whole plot was in motion in 94, and the Philippines police gave it to the feds in 1995, April, and they blew it. They just dropped the ball. They didn't pursue it.
Now, let's just cover that. There were three parts to Yusuf's plot. One was to kill the Pope, the second one was Bojinka, and the third one was the plan to hijack American planes and crash them into the Sears building, the Transamerica building, the CIA building, the World Trade Center, and the Pentagon.
Right.
And this was known in 1995 or 1994. The Philippines told the American government that the FBI knew this and did absolutely nothing. Once they knew that there was a plan to hijack planes here to protect the World Trade Center, other than, of course, to insist that they lock the doors so nobody could escape to the roof, other than to tell the people in the South Tower, you're not to leave your posts just because they've blown up the North Tower. And you wonder, was this just stupidity, or could it possibly be something far more sinister? But this was the operation some people refer to as Bojinka. You say it's a separate plot, but all of these were known, the three plots that were found in the laptop computer when it was found in Manila. Let's talk just a moment about the relationship between Ramzi Yousef and Sheikh Khalid Muhammad and Terry Nichols, because this is so important, and that too has been suppressed by the government.
Right. Terry Nichols, many people don't realize, Terry Nichols, of course, was convicted with McVeigh in the Oklahoma City bombings. McVeigh went to his death insisting they acted alone, and McVeigh, you know, was executed. Nichols is about to be tried, if Attorney General Ashcroft allows it, because the prosecutor in Oklahoma City is complaining now that the Justice Department is stonewalling on turning over enough evidence for them to actually try him so that he could get the death penalty. But Terry Nichols' wife, Marife, was a mail-order Filipino bride. And he spent, we found out, four separate trips to the Philippines in the 1990s, with no visible means of support. I mean, you have to understand, this guy was working as a ranch hand. He had no visible means of support. Yet somehow, when he went to the Philippines on this last trip, he left letters behind, a storage locker with $60,000 in gold bullion and other jewels and things like that. And he basically had been in the Philippines in Cebu City. Now, remember I said that Yousef did that test flight from Manila to this obscure town in the southern Philippines. At the same time, Yousef was in this town. Terry Nichols was in that town. Prior to Terry Nichols being in the Philippines at the time of master bomber Ramzi Yousef, he and McVeigh had only tried to blow up one ammonium nitrate fuel oil device. It was in a metal milk jug, and it fizzled. Michael Fortier, the star witness of the government, who was their friend, said these guys couldn't do it. They didn't know how to build this kind of bomb. After 9/11, after Nichols is with Yousef in Manila, they take down the Oklahoma City Federal Building, okay? Edwin Angeles, who is a Abu Sayyaf leader, this is the group I mentioned that Yousef had worked with, the Al-Qaeda group, he said in a sworn affidavit, I have a copy of, with his thumbprint, that in the early 90s he met Yousef, Murad, and a fellow named Terry Nichols, a.k.a. the Farmer. They were in a room together. I interviewed Stephen Jones, who is McVeigh's lawyer, who said that his original plan for the defense was to present this evidence that Yousef taught them how to build a bomb. He told me that McVeigh was questioned, interrogated by the defense team, and had no knowledge of bomb building, claimed that he got a book out of the Kingman, Arizona library. They checked. There was no such book. He did a crude drawing of the bomb that my 16-year-old son could have drawn. You and I could have drawn it, doctor. I mean, this guy did not have the bomb-making capability. And all of a sudden, when Terry Nichols is in the Philippines with Ramzi Yousef, the building goes down. Now, on the 19th of April, 1995, the day of the bombing, Abdullah Kim Murad, who'd been interrogated by the Philippines police, who had given up this third plot, this 9/11 plot, had just been extradited back to the U.S. He's in the Metropolitan Correctional Center, the MCC, federal jail in Lower Manhattan. As soon as he hears the radio report, we have done that. That's us. And the guard rushed in and said, what are you talking about? And he said, we did that. The 5th Battalion of the Liberation Army, which is what Ramzi called his cell. And they even sent two FBI agents over who memorialized that in what's called an FBI 302, which is a special memo they produced. And they literally, doctor, introduced that at the Bojinka plot, at a trial, as evidence that as late as April, Murad was involved in a conspiracy. This is the feds taking his admission against interest that he's involved in this plot and using it to prove that he's involved in a conspiracy. Yet to this day, the feds said, even though they sought this John Doe number two, the sketches showed a guy who looked like a swarthy Middle Easterner. Terry Nichols was a, you know, pencil-necked, thin, balding white man. They basically have insisted to this day that they acted alone. And I think I make a very credible, circumstantial case that Ramzi Yousef designed that bomb that took down that federal building.
Well, I think that people should read Stephen Jones' book, Others Unknown, Oklahoma City Bombing Conspiracy, because, of course, the trial opened with something that the average American has never heard. And that was what Stephen Jones said. You know, Timothy McVeigh had written to his sister, Jennifer, and said, I am part of a secret the Special Forces unit, which is involved in illegal activity. So what's this all about? Well, we don't want to get off into that, but there's a lot of unanswered questions, a lot of things the American people are not being told. So basically, Yosef lays out the plan for hijacking planes. This is in 1995, and the Filipino police know that. You've actually got a sworn affidavit, don't you, from the people over there in the Philippines saying they told our government all about it?
Yeah, in fact, Colonel Mendoza, Colonel Rodolfo Boogie Mendoza, who's a fantastic man, who I did perhaps the most extensive interview with, he's the guy who interrogated Yusuf's partner for 67 days. And if, in my book, you'll see at the end of my book, a FBI 302 of the Marad's extradition interrogation where he comes back into the country. First of all, Marad just says in that report, in black and white, in an FBI memo from 1995, quote, Marad advises that Ramzi wanted to return to New York to bomb the Trade Center a second time. That's a direct quote from this memo. And then when Colonel Mendoza, on the day of 9/11, it was actually nighttime over there, 13 hours ahead, was watching, was just filling out a report. He was text messaged on his Nokia, urgent, turn on CNN. He turns on CNN. He sees the South Tower collapsing. The first words out of his mouth, Doctor, they have done it. They have done it. Well, you see, I mean, police officers in the Philippines had known about this for years, and they just assumed that the feds were on it. They just assumed that our great law enforcement, you know, machinery in this country would have gotten on there to their lead and would have stopped this.
Well, you know, what's really so interesting is that Bill Gertz writes for the Washington Times and obviously gets a lot of inside leaks from the government. That's why, of course, he is so much a well-known reporter. But he wrote something in July of the year 2001, 2 months before the World Trade Center bombing, where he described the whole operation, hijacking the planes, crashing them into the World Trade Center, crashing them into the Pentagon, crashing them into the White House, Sears Tower, Transamerica Building. It was picked up. We actually have the email report, and really what's so interesting is that when he came out with his book Breakdown, and he said, well, there was a plot, but it was only to hijack the planes and crash them into the CIA building.
One little plane, right. That was one of the myths of this. Go ahead.
So actually, I had him as a guest on my program. I congratulated him for the fine job he had done writing 2 months ahead of time about the plan to bomb the... crash the planes to the World Trade Center. He said that was wrong. I said, how could it be wrong? That's exactly what happened.
I
never should have written that. That wasn't true at all. And obviously somebody put pressure on him to not to let the American people know, because if the American people realized they knew ahead of time, think of the implications.
By the way, would you email me, if you have that email, would you send it to PeterLance.com and my, you know, just email me, because you mentioned that before and I did not realize that. That's quite a breakthrough that you put together there, and I'd really like to see that.
Oh, we'll be glad to get your
early reporting, you know.
Well, and now that is, what is your email?
Well, if you just go to PeterLance.com and scroll down to the bottom, you'll see it. It says contact.
All right,
and you'll be able to just send it to me.
We'll certainly get that for you. In fact, we have another one that came off the Washington Times about the same time, 2 months beforehand. And that was even on after that, but Bill Gertz, somebody didn't think to take that down. Anyway, the great tragedy is so much was known before 9/11, and right now everything in Washington, D.C. is cover up. We will not let the investigating committee investigate, and if there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing it? And I think we both know why. Well, anyway, then, of course, Ramzi Yosef goes back over to Pakistan. He is intercepted in 1995, arrested and brought to the United States. And so then what happens?
So then the federal government just did what they had been doing for years. It took these as individual legal cases to be prosecuted and won, as opposed to evidence of an international conspiracy. Remember, the Nasser case was called a lone gunman case, and that was done by the local DA in New York, but the Fed supported that. Then they prosecuted Mahmoud Abu-Lima, Salema, Ajaj, and Nidal Ayad for the first World Trade Center bombing before they had Yusuf. They were found guilty. Then they captured the Sheikh through the good work of Imad Salem, Nancy Floyd's asset. He was prosecuted for the bridge and tunnel plot, convicted with nine others. He went to jail. each time they predicted victory. It's like every time you hear that bin Laden is dead, you know, they predict victory. Well, they continue to approach this as a series of legal cases to be won as opposed to an international conspiracy. And then they had Ramzi. So even though they had this evidence from Colonel Mendoza of this third plot, they figured, you know what, we're going to convict him of Bojinka, which they did. We're going to convict him of the World Trade Center bombing, which they had a separate trial of, and they did. And basically, that's it. We're going to lock him up for 240 years in solitary confinement, in lockdown, special administrative measures, and he's gone and the threat is over.
But of course,
and that's the approach they took. But was the threat over? Clearly not.
In fact, when they captured Ramzi Yousef in Pakistan, wasn't he living in a home that was owned by a man named Osama bin Laden?
It was a guest house. And his own uncle was on the ground floor. Our great, you know, feds. And the FBI, by the way, falsely took credit for the capture. But they are actually to blame for Khalid Sheikh being let go, because Bradley Garrett, who's the FBI agent who was over at the time looking for Kanzi, remember Amir Kanzi, the CIA shooter, the guy who killed the two men outside the CIA?
Right.
He was basically another Baluchistani like Yousef. And he, although he claimed himself that he acted alone and wasn't tied into Yousef's cell, Bradley Garrett was over in Pakistan looking for him the day of the Yousef takedown. The actual arrest was effected by agents of the Diplomatic Security Service and the DEA. The FBI showed up 15 to 20 minutes later at the guest house. Well, guess what? When they show up at the guest house, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is giving interviews to Time magazine and meets Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who went on to be the mastermind of 9/11 to execute his nephew's plot. I mean, it's phenomenal. It's like Keystone Cops time. But on the other hand, you start to think, is it really? Are they really that incompetent? Or is there some other agenda here?
Well, that is the $64,000 question. I don't think that anybody could be that dumb unintentionally. For our listeners, let me repeat what Peter said. It was this Sheikh Khalid Mohammed. Who was giving interviews to Time magazine in 1995, who was on the bottom floor.
His own name, by the way, doctor.
Beg your pardon?
He used his own name.
Right.
And he had 30 aliases. And if you read the Time magazine from the week after Yousef's capture, the title of the story is "The Man Who Wasn't There." And they were, of course, referring to Ramzi Yousef, right? But the real man who wasn't there was his uncle. Because his uncle, they quote a Karachi businessman named Khalid Sheikh, who describes with great specificity, they came in like a hurricane, they stormed the room, they captured this man, blah, 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 blah. That was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So while the feds got the nephew, they didn't get, it's like taking a tick out where you take the head off, but you don't get the rest of the tick inside the body. And the tick infects the body. In this case, the guy just carried out his nephew's plot, which became 9/11.
And the thing is that they had the testimony of Edward Angeles over in the Philippines that the Sheikh Khalid Mohammed and, of course, Ramzi Yousef and Murad and the others were over there in 1995. They knew that they were all in this together, and yet, of course, they let the Sheikh go, Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, and he was the mastermind behind 9/11. And, of course, the great, great tragedy that occurred and the lives that were lost, and it was all, in my estimation, totally unnecessary. Well,
right.
Now,
absolutely,
of course,
preventable.
You really weave an amazing story of the various personalities and of Mr. Salem. He's a fascinating individual. This is the Egyptian who infiltrated at great risk to himself. They would have certainly killed him if they'd realized he was an FBI informant. And he today is what, living somewhere?
Witness protection.
And then there was the FBI agent, Nancy Floyd, who really had, was working almost two jobs. She was actually assigned to having something to do with the Russians. She was actually in the evenings, every evening, talking to Salem, encourage him, to keep him working so he would actually infiltrate. Because he could speak the language and he understood the terrorists. He hated what they were doing because they'd killed Sadat. And he was really quite willing to help the Americans take them down, and yet he was treated rudely and he was treated crudely, and really they did everything they could almost to drive him away, didn't they?
Yeah, this is this guy Carson Dunbar, the man with the shoes off, you know, that literally risked the life of this asset when he had him come into 26 Federal Plaza to the FBI. Continued to insist. Do you know that Carson Dunbar, as recently as last the summer of 92, I got the first interview ever that he's ever given on this. And then last June 6th, I did another extensive interview just before publication of the book. Continues to insist that Salem was an incompetent, that Salem was a liar. And yet Salem did everything he said. Lou Napoli, one of the cops involved from the task, joint terrorist task, said, Peter, this guy delivered. He brought it home. He was the guy. He was the government's linchpin witness that convicted the sheikh. Here's Carson Dunbar, years later, trying to, justify his own failure in stopping Youssef by blaming Nancy Floyd and impeaching the credibility of her linchpin witness. Incredible. And where Carson Dunbar got a sweetheart deal where he was allowed to transfer the ATF to keep his federal pension, serving in a kind of a ghost job in Washington while he ran the New Jersey State Police, Nancy Floyd was set up in a 5.5-year internal affairs investigation where she couldn't move ahead in the bureau, could not get a raise, couldn't get an advancement, and we had a cloud over her head for 5.5 years, and ultimately was found insubordinate to Carson Dunbar in what I consider to be simply a tactical disagreement over how Salem should have been treated. She was suspended, doctor, her badge and her gun confiscated, put on the street for 2 weeks, humiliated. After, by the way, they vilified her in the tabloid press, they sent a story to the New York Post, The Temptress and the Spy, alleging that she was having an affair with Salem, which was completely false. You know, they ruined her reputation, and then they ruined her professionally. And she's a courageous young agent. She's still with the Bureau. She has 7 years to go, and she should be celebrated. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, for the first time telling her story, Special Agent Nancy Floyd.
And, of course, what had happened was that the Blind Sheik and his people there were planning on massive bombs. They had another bomb builder, and they were going to blow up the Harlem Tunnel, the Brooklyn Bridge. They had, about a dozen sites that were going to blow up all at one time. And the only reason it didn't happen was because of Nancy Floyd and Mr. Salem, and yet they were both vilified by high officials in the FBI, who were then coddled. And what was really so infuriating is the high officials in the FBI were all coddled, and the poor street agents, the people who are down there risking their lives and working their heart outs, will be subjected to these investigations and humiliated, and they leak these articles like they would leak the article about Nancy Floyd. These are intentional leaks to discredit people, and when government does that, that's a criminal activity, and yet they do it routinely.
They did it to John O'Neill. You know, John O'Neill was essentially the main guy who was the Paul Revere of Osama bin Laden inside the Bureau. And John O'Neill had to leave. He was drummed out of the FBI. So a story was leaked to the New York Times, and it pretty much was the death knell in his career, alleging that he was the subject of an OPR. And he ended up, tragically and ironically, taking a job as head of security, the World Trade Center, only to die in the same tower that Ronnie Bucca died in. I've challenged Director Mueller multiple times in the media, and I have a program that was on Book TV, the C-SPAN program, last Sunday, and I'm hoping they're going to replay it. If you go to my website, peterlance.com, you can actually play this program I did on C-SPAN, and I challenged Director Mueller. If there's anything in my book that's wrong, if the FBI disagrees with me in any way, shape, or form, and they can prove that I'm wrong, tell me, and I'll make a correction, and I'll admit it. But I, to this day, I haven't had any point of substantive reaction from the FBI other than calling my book a rehash or like a little one-line slur. And I'm the first journalist ever that's named names. I have accountability in this book for why the World Trade Center, the two attacks happened on these two beautiful buildings. I'm, the one journalist that did it. The Joint Commission, Tim Romer and Max Cleland, two of the commissioners, have taken my book. Max Cleland actually read from it at the October 14th hearing and used it to kick off the questioning. I have a series of questions that I'm submitting to the commissioners in the next 10 days that I would like to see answered as an American and a journalist, but as an American first. And among them, ask yourselves, commissioners, could Ramzi Youssef have been stopped in 1992? And if so, why wasn't he? I think that's a valid question for this commission to study. And was Nancy Floyd unfairly treated? Was there a cover-up in the New York office? Could they have stopped the 9/11 by focusing on Colonel Mendoza's evidence? Why wasn't Colonel Mendoza By the way, Colonel Mendoza, during the whole Bojinka trial, even though Colonel Mendoza was the chief interrogator of Abdul Hakim Murad, they brought 11 police guys over from Manila to testify. Colonel Mendoza was never called.
We're out of time. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll do it again sometime real soon. Good night.
Thank you.
Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you once again that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we didn't take any calls in the last hour because I wanted you to hear as much as you could of Peter Lance and his story, A Thousand Years for Revenge. They knew about Operation Bojinka. They knew that they were planning on hitting the World Trade Center, and they've consistently lied about it. And that's one reason why they can't release the briefing information. They couldn't let the American people know the truth because the average American could not accept the truth. Well, Peter initially had said he could only be with us an hour. Then he said, well, he's back in Washington, D.C., and he's alone there, and so he'd be glad to do 2 hours. And then this evening he just said, well, it's getting late. I think I can only do 1 hour. So suddenly we were faced with the second hour without a guest. But fortunately, our good friend John Leffler, who had done a program with me earlier today that we'll be playing in 2 weeks on our Saturday program, John Leffler volunteered to do the second hour after we called him, of course. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Hello. Doing well. Nothing like last minute. You know, the worst thing you can be as a talk show host is to discover your guest isn't going to be there.
Well, anyway, I thought maybe we could even talk a little bit about what we talked about this morning, the process of globalization. So this is something that you'd like to talk about.
You know, I have a couple of pages here. I don't know if you want to spend some time letting me read a page or two.
Sure. My goodness, if you're good enough to come on to rescue me at this time, I have no objection. You go ahead and read a page or two. Because whenever John has anything written out, it's usually well worthwhile hearing.
Well, actually, I didn't write this. This was written some time ago, but I ran across it today, and I thought, geez, this is really interesting because it's virtually everything that's coming true. Let me just start reading this thing here, okay? And then if you need to break in, do that. It says here, the new era into which we are entering is what might be called the religious phase of human history. By religious, we do not mean that men will turn to God, but rather that the indifference to the absolute, which characterized the liberal phase of civilization, will be succeeded by a passion for an absolute. From now on, the struggle will not be for the colonies and national rights, but for the souls of men. There will be no more half-drawn swords, no divided loyalties, no broad strokes of sophomoric tolerance. There will not even be any more great heresies, for heresies are based on partial acceptance of truth. The battle lines are already being clearly drawn, and the basic issues are no longer in doubt. From now on, men will divide themselves into two religions, understood again as surrender to an absolute. The conflict of the future is between the absolute who is the God-man and the absolute, which is the man God, the God who became man, and the man who makes himself God, brothers in Christ, and comrades in Antichrist. The Antichrist will not be so called, otherwise he would have no followers. He will not wear red tights, nor vomit sulfur, nor carry a trident, nor wave an arrowed tail, just like Mephistopheles did in Faust. This masquerade has helped the devil convince men that he does not exist. When no man recognizes, the more power he exercises. God has defined himself as I am who am, and the devil as I am who am not. Nowhere in sacred scripture do we find warrant for the popular myth of the devil as a buffoon who is dressed up like the first red. Rather, he is described as a fallen angel from heaven and as the prince of this world, whose business is to tell us that there is no other world. His logic is simple. If there is no heaven, there is no hell. If there is no hell, then there is no sin. If there is no sin, then there is no judge, and if there is no judgment, then evil is good and good is evil. But above all these descriptions, our Lord tells us that he will be so much like himself that he would deceive even the elect, and certainly no devil ever seen in picture books could deceive even the elect. How will he come in this new age to win the followers to his religion? The pre-communist Russian belief is that he would become disguised as the great humanitarian. He will talk peace, prosperity, and plenty, not as a means to lead us to God, but as ends in themselves. He will write books on the new idea of God to suit the way people live, induce faith in astrology so as to make not the will but the stars responsible for sins. He will explain guilt away psychologically as inhibited eroticism and make men shrink in shame of their fellow men if they say that they are not broad-minded and liberal. He will be so broad-minded as to identify tolerance with indifference to right and wrong, truth and error. He will spread the lie that men will never be better until they make society better, and thus they have selfishness to provide fuel for the next revolution. He will foster science, but only to have armament makers use one marvel of science to destroy another. He will foster more divorces under the disguise that another partner is vital. He will increase love for love and decrease love for person. He will invoke religion to destroy religion. He will even speak of Christ, and he will say that he was the greatest man who ever lived. His mission, he will say, will be to liberate men from the servitudes of superstition and fascism, which he will never define. He will organize children's games, tell people whom they should and should not marry and unmarry, who should bear children and who should not. He will benevolently draw chocolate bars from his pockets for the little ones and bottles of milk for the Hottentots. He will tempt Christians with the same three temptations with which he tempted Christ. The temptation to turn stones into bread as an earthly Messiah will become the temptation to sell freedom for security, making bread a political weapon which only those who think his way may eat. The temptation to work a miracle by recklessly throwing himself from a steeple will become a plea to desert the lofty pinnacles of truth where faith and reason reign for those lower depths where the masses live on slogans and propaganda. He wants no proclamation of immutable principles from the lofty heights of a steeple, but rather mass organization through propaganda where only a common man directs the idiosyncrasies of common men. Opinions, not truths, commentators, not teachers, Gallup polls, not principles, nature, not grace. To these golden calves will men toss themselves from their Christ. The third temptation in which Satan asks Christ to adore him and all the kingdoms of the world would be his, will become the temptation to have a new religion without a cross, a liturgy without a world to come, a religion to destroy a religion, or a politics which is a religion, one that renders unto Caesar even the things that are God's. In the midst of all of his seeming love for humanity and his glib talk of freedom and equality, he will have one great secret which he will tell no one. He will not believe in God. And because his religion will be brotherhood without the fatherhood of God, he will deceive even the elect. He will set up a counter-church, which will be the ape of the church, because he, the devil, is the ape of God. It will have all the notes and characteristics of the church, but in reverse and emptied of its divine content. It will be a mystical body of the Antichrist that will, in all externals, resemble the mystical body of Christ. In desperate need for God, whom he nevertheless refuses to adore, modern man, in his loneliness and frustration, will hunger more and more for membership in a community that will give him enlargement of purpose, but at the cost of losing himself in some vague collectivity. Hold on just a minute, Stephen.
Whatever John is reading is really right on, because, as you know, if you listen to our programs regularly, there really is a spiritual battle taking place between God and the Antichrist, the devil himself. This is not imaginary. There really are tremendous spiritual forces. You can tap into them many, many ways, but you do so at the risk of your eternal soul. There is hidden wisdom. There is hidden power out there that, of course, many people access. And if you access it, you'll have great wealth. You'll have all sorts of sexual excesses. You will be one of the leaders of society and the leaders of our time. But, of course, life is transient, and eternity goes on forever. So go ahead and pick up there.
Well, that was the passage right there. Sorry about that. One of my boys was trying to log on to the Internet. It was written, if you can believe this, I was astounded. I had someone read this to me today over the phone, and it was like reading today's headlines. He talks about tolerance. He talks about using religion to destroy religion, to make everything into communitarianism, to have commentators rather than leaders, etc. This was written by Fulton J. Sheen in 1948.
Well, he certainly does beautifully. In fact, he talks about the brotherhood of man. I'll never forget what Fulton Sheen said one time. To advocate the brotherhood of man without the fatherhood of God is to make all men a race of bastards. And I really thought that was so profound, because there is no brotherhood of man unless we have a common father.
Absolutely. It's just incredible.
And, of course, he was silenced by the Catholic Church. He was, doing a great job. He was on television. He was getting a lot of followers. And the word was put out. He was just to not do that anymore. But I think he was probably much closer to the truth than he was getting closer to the truth, and perhaps an embarrassment out of the Catholic hierarchy at the time.
Well, it was interesting. I was talking to someone today about this, that it was Cardinal Spellman who sort of quietly under the table. Remember the game of Romani Ta that Malachi Martin always talked about? And that's the same game, so to speak, that exists in some of the hierarchy that allowed the whole pedophilia scandal to get as far as it did. But the interesting part is that he was able to tack this down as early on. I remember Richard Gardner in the Council on Foreign Relations magazine in 1974 was talking about the great booming and buzzing that would happen as we moved into this new world order that he talked about. And the funny part is, Dr. Stan, they use the word the new order, the new world order, the new global governance. They're talking about it all the time. When we comment on it, we're crazy. See what I'm saying? They would never do that. Yet that's very clearly what they mean in a lot of the articles that they write and things of this nature. And it's this very concealed dialectical process. But there's one thing after we talked this morning, and I read this and did a lot of thinking today. We're really on the way. We're moving in the direction that Scripture said, and that's important, because I get a lot of calls here. I don't know about you at Radio Liberty, but people wanting to know what they can quote do, quote unquote. But I always point out that where everybody is a matter of personal station and position, because we're all in different locations. And the first thing that people need to understand is when you move into these times. These are not new times. There's nothing new about where we are headed, despite all of the proclamations of the fact that this is forward-thinking, progressive thinking, etc. Anytime anyone has used that, we're really retrograding or retrogressing back into places we have been before over the last 300 and 400 years, ever since the French Revolution. And so you have to ask yourself, what do these times mean for people who pass through them? And the biggest attack is always in the area of faith and freedom, because it's by faith we are saved, by faith we are kept saved. Jesus said, he who holds his faith to the end shall be saved. And as a result of that, that's where the attacks will come. And if we look at, I'm not going to get into deep eschatology as far as the theory of the rapture, but I did notice throughout the Scriptures, there's a constant emphasis on maintaining faith, patience and endurance, that type of thing. And that theme is issued over and over and over again. And I think we're coming into times just like that. And one way to prepare for this is you can prepare financially. You can also prepare mentally and philosophically, understanding what the times are, because they do require a different mindset, a different thought. I was going through Daniel earlier in the week, especially you've been talking to some people that are in Iraq by phone, trying to find out what's going on in the coalition there. And I said, you know, you really need to read the book of Daniel because it was written where you are. And one of the interesting comments is that in the end times, Antichrist brings down many by peace, this process of peace, and he will make deceit prosper. And the one thing that the Christian church just does not seem to grapple with is the fact that we really are in a war and a battle, and that the first thrust of any warfare is the art of deception. Even Sun Tzu said that from thousands of years ago, that the first act of war is deception. The first thing you have to recognize is I am under attack, and that the best deception is one which is 99% true. So that's something that it's very foreign to Christians living in the West, because for so long everything seemed to be right side up, and now it's turning upside down, which again is why God gives us the woe in the Scriptures. Woe unto those who call evil good and good evil, and black white and white black. Because after a while, it really does become a mad machine. You know, a lot of our troops, even some of the officers that are in the coalition, are getting demoralized now because they recognize they're not being allowed to do what they think they're over there to do, which is to bring our form of government into Iraq and to stabilize it. They become aware of that there's a second game in motion. There are a lot of CIA spooks running around and other things. But they don't know what that game is. They don't understand it. It's the same thing in the church growth movements here in this country. When suddenly this church growth movement starts, and the people in the churches look and go, gee, something's wrong, but I can't tell you what it is. They can sense it, but they don't have the mental tools or the background to shape it out. Same thing for people who are in developmental programs and work, like total quality management programs. And they go by different names in every company. But once again, they know that something is wrong instinctively, but because there are so few that actually recognize that something's wrong, they think, well, it must be me who's the kook, when in reality it's everybody else who is going along to get along, that type of thing. So I would say some kind of mental apprehension on the part of people to what is going on, to understand that we are in a major paradigm shift right now. And during a paradigm shift, you have bits of the old and bits of the new. And as a result of that, it's very difficult for people who are not looking at what I call the trend lines to understand what's happening, because all they're looking at are the little details.
Well, I think that the American people are not prepared for what is about to occur here. And as our attention is focused on what's going on overseas, America is going through a cataclysmic change. And as we talked about this morning, our major industries are being intentionally and purposely moved offshore. Our best jobs, at least over 13% of our best paying jobs now, are gone, and they will not come back again. And we, of course, are told by our government that, oh, everything's fine, look at all the new jobs we've created. Well, just for the month of October, we created 116,000 new jobs, according to a recent article by, Roberts, John Paul Roberts, or...
Paul Craig Roberts,
yeah. Right. But, of course, what they didn't mention, we lost 170,000 jobs, and the 116,000 that they created were part-time jobs, working at minimum wage. The ones we lost were good jobs, and they're
right.
Not coming back again.
Yeah.
And the massive debts we have, I mean, both here in the state of California, where even the state treasurer said, you can't go out and borrow any more money, but Arnold Schwarzenegger's insisting we're going to get another bond for $15 billion, and that's going to solve our problems. The only way you're going to solve the problems of the state debts and of the national debt is simply to do away with them through inflation, and that impoverishes the middle class and the average person, a senior person, living on retirement with their CDs and their pensions and their annuities and their savings accounts, doesn't understand they are about to be impoverished. And of course, as these things unfold, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to look to government to solve their problem without the realization that their government is under the control of the dark side, and it has created all of these problems. I believe that there are dark spiritual forces working at the highest levels of both political parties, and all you need to do is see Gene Houston being invited to the White House by Hillary Clinton to conjure up some spirits for her. Eleanor Roosevelt, Mahatma Gandhi, Nancy Reagan inviting the astrologer there to tell her how to advise the President of the United States. And, of course, what most people do not know is that Ronald Reagan was involved with astrology as well. And here we see both Democrats and Republicans reaching to the dark side for answers to man's problems, and that is not where the answers are going to come from. And until we have enlightened leadership who really believes in God, rather than, of course, following the dark side in an effort to bring utopia, and there's no way we're ever going to have utopia. The meaning of that word is no place. We have leadership today that is leading us, as the Pied Piper of Hamlet led the children of Hamlet to their destruction.
Right. Every single one of these financial problems, you know, they will turn to the very same people who got them into the trouble in the first place, which is the chief idiocy. But it's largely because their worldview doesn't allow them to understand what it is that is happening. One thing we do know is that there is a horrible train wreck coming in the very near future that is unavoidable, especially in the area of Social Security and Medicare, and that at some point our government is going to have to begin reneging on promises it has made to its people.
Well, that's really what this new Medicare bill that they're talking about. They're trying to sell it to the American people under the guise of, we're here from the government, we're here to help. We want you to be able to get cheap drugs, you know, and so we're going to subsidize your drugs, and it's only going to cost $40 billion over the next 10 years, but anybody with a half an ounce of sense knows that they're always off by a factor of about 90%. It'll probably cost closer to $400 billion. And in fact, I recently had a fellow on my program. We were talking about the situation as far as the Canadian drugs were concerned, and he was obviously being paid by somebody in the drug industry to discourage people buying drugs from Canada. And the remark was, well, we can't have people buying drugs from Canada, you know, because they could be made in Pakistan or in India or Lower Slavovia, and we don't want people getting drugs that we don't know what's in them. And I said, what about the drugs that are made by Abbott Laboratory? They're made here in the United States and packed in the United States, and then they're sent up to Canada where they're sold at a third the cost. What's wrong with people buying those drugs and bringing them in? Oh, he says that's against the law. And I said, the truth of the matter is, the drug companies doesn't have to spend, you know, to sell drugs anywhere in the world cheaper than they want to. What
right.
They're doing is using the American people to subsidize everybody throughout the world. We're subsidizing the Canadian socialist system, socialized medical system. We're subsidizing, giving these drugs to people all throughout the world at a markedly reduced price, and that money is coming out of the hide of the American
right.
people. And I said, you know, you have these high-priced drugs here. What are we going to do? You know, you're so concerned about the people. What about the Americans who can't afford to buy the drugs? And
right.
his response was, well, that's why we need the new Medicare bill, you know, so that the government will subsidize the drugs. And I said, well, where does the government get their money?
Right.
And I don't think he'd ever thought that answer to that question.
Yeah,
well, the government has the money. Government doesn't have any money other than what it takes from us by force, of what, of course, it borrows from future generations, or what, of course, creates out of inflation. And that's really what they're going to do. They're going to inflate the economy. They're going to inflate our dollars. They're going to destroy the value of the currency and impoverish the people, the very people, supposedly, that they're trying to help.
Absolutely. You know, the funny part is that the... as long as you can sell the dream that there's a bottomless pit of money, you can make this thing fly. That's what California is facing right now, is the fact that as long as you believe there are rich people to be soaked, you can somehow make the dream fly. But what you don't realize is that, say we had a stable money system and you wanted to soak the rich, there aren't enough rich people to soak. It's just too large a budget. You could take 100% of what these rich people make, and it still wouldn't support the voracious appetite. We don't have a taxation problem. We don't have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. There's a big difference between the two. And right now, all of these, I mean, listen, this whole Social Security Medicare debacle will require almost a doubling of the payroll taxes. Think of this, Dr. Stan. It's staggering within 10 years in order just to support this once the baby boomers begin kicking in, as far as wanting retirement benefits. And that means that the government is either A, going to have to inflate, or B, begin reneging on its promises to to a generation of people who have paid in their entire lives and expect to retire collecting out of this, and Mother Hubbard's cupboard is going to be desperately bare.
Well, this is what they're doing over in Israel. That's why there were a general strikes there against Netanyahu, who is the finance minister in Israel. This is what they're doing in France and Germany, and they're just saying, we're going to cut benefits. And the people are yelling and screaming, we're entitled to this, we're entitled to it. And people don't understand that in a free society, you're not entitled to anything.
Right. But you know, in essence, they sort of are entitled, because that's what they were promised. You know, even if they forgot to read the fine print, what I'm pointing out, and you're right about that, you know, there is no real entitlement. There's no entitlement here, by the way, Dr. Stan. The way Social Security is put together, not only is it a Ponzi scheme, it's basically a tax. And once you've paid the tax, you really don't have any right to claim anything. So if they slam the window shut tomorrow, legally you have no right. But morally, that's what everybody was led to believe, you see. And so there's the element here, even if this were to go to court, say on an affinity fraud type of situation, you were led to believe that you had this right, and you were led to believe that there was a trust fund into which the money was placed. So that doesn't fly. Now, that means that there's a lot of civil unrest coming. So that's why you can see a lot of the preparations on the part of government. See, everybody sees the train wreck. Well, I take that back. The people at the top see the train wreck coming. The politicians can't admit it because they need to keep their careers going. And remember, their pensions are set aside and come from separate sources, so they're guaranteed. They'll still be sitting pretty while everybody else is dying out here. That's number one. They can't admit it. The people at the bottom don't know what to believe because they're getting so much misinformation backwards and forwards. And so there's only a small group of people out here who really recognizes what's going to happen. So that's where the situation is. So when it train wrecks, I think you're going to see a lot of violence. I mean, a friend of mine used to do computer programming for the state of Colorado, and he told me one day, he said, their computer systems went down, and they almost had a riot at one of the welfare offices.
Well, you know, the FEMA, or I should say the Office of Homeland Security, but working with FEMA, which is in there, are actually building detention camps all across America in a case of some sort of a national emergency. And Chris Ruddy ran some articles on this, gave the article references the FEMA websites. They're not going to be completed for until 2004, 2005. But why are they building massive detention camps in America? Well, I think that it's exactly what you're saying. They know there's going to be civil unrest. There is going to be civil unrest all throughout Europe when they begin taking the pensions that people have been told that they're going to get, and they're just not going to have them because there is no money and there's no way that they can continue paying out as they have. They have spent all the money in Social Security and Medicare, and they will continue doing it. It was a great scam. It was great during the Vietnam War. That's how we could have guns and butter. And, of course, how often have you heard, well, you know, actually, it's the rich who are paying most of the income tax. The poor are not paying any income tax. No, what they're doing is putting 15% of their income into Social Security, but they never mention that. They talk about the income tax, and yet, of course, Social Security is a tax, and there is no fund, there is no lockbox. That simply is being used to pay off such things as, well, so we can give $20 billion to the Iraqis so they can give the money to the Soviets who they owe money to. So we're going to give money to Iraq so they can pay back the loans to the Soviet Union or to the Russians.
Right.
What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, we're basically funding everything the way that the World Bank and everything else has been set up. The U.S. taxpayer is the guarantee of last resort for absolutely everything. And you're absolutely right. But it's done through such a mechanism that most people don't understand it. So the bottom line is, say for individuals, now that you know where it's going, there's only two ways out. One is that I can say, one is to renege on the promises made, you know, by delaying the age of retirement, cutting the benefits down. You know the syndrome, right? Or B, inflating until there's no tomorrow, in which everybody gets paid their dollars, but the dollars won't be worth much.
Well, I have said, and I think it's probably fairly valid, I have the only logical solution to Medicare, and that is that we'll move the age of retirement up to 84. And at that time, you can retire with full Social Security and Medicare benefits, and the whole system will be financially stable. But other than raising the age up to 80 or 84, there's no way this system is going to survive.
Right, and so there you stand. So that's basically it. But I don't know. I was, I'm getting, I guess, troubled by what I say for a change, because I thought the whole train is not being driven by sanity. And that's more what I've noticed than anything else. It's just, there is no reason in what I'm seeing here. And I don't hear the politicians speaking of it either.
But you're not even hearing our leaders, the quasi-leadership, our religious leadership, our political leadership. There are a few of them, of course, who are out there trying to tell us what's happening, but of course they're not being heard. Well, we're going to have to take a break, and when we get back, though, we want to invite our listeners to give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for John, I think it's an important subject. There is a spiritual battle going on. It's about time we recognize who the real adversary is. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that we are having a meeting. It's going to be a week from tomorrow at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and we're hoping that many of you will be able to come. We've brought in some excellent speakers from outside. It's going to be all day from 8:30 in the morning until 5 in the evening. There'll be an hour that we'll have a panel discussion. So if you have any questions that you wanted to ask or always afraid to, here's a wonderful opportunity. There'll be lunch served. There'll be a material passed out. I think it'll be a good time. And so if you'd like to come, give us a call. We have to know how many people are going to be there because of the luncheon. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And bring your friends. Please talk it up. We'd like to get as large a crowd as we can. This is not a good weekend. November 29th, 30th is the weekend where more people travel than any other time in the entire nation. I know I tried to get I tried to get myself a plane ticket for the 30th, and to fly back to Boston was going to cost me $2,000 simply because there is no space at that time. Everybody's on the road. So I'm not going to be taking a plane trip, needless to say. But under any circumstances, we do hope many of you will decide you'd like to come. And if you're here in California or there's any way you can get here, we'll be glad to provide you a map. We'll be glad to provide you with a list of the various places where you can stay, and we're looking, hopefully, that as many people as possible can come. Joan Paris is going to be talking about the USA Patriot Act, and this is really such an important issue because it's a total departure from the American concept of individual freedom. The legislation negates, in the name of fighting terrorism, Islamic terrorism, the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment. But the big problem is there's no mention of Islamic terrorism there, and this legislation is being used for all sorts of criminal intervention, and it was never having to do it with Islamic terrorism, but they had to have that as a gimmick. Now, they say, we have to have this for the Islamic terrorists. Fine, then use it for the Islamic terrorists, but why are you using it for all these other people? Well, they deserve to be in jail. Why do they deserve to be in jail? Because they're guilty. How do you know they're guilty? They're not going to tell you because they are going to arrest them and they're going to go after them. And you know what you do when you get a federal charge? They slap on about 59 different charges against you, so you'll serve 540 years in prison unless you pre-bargain. And when they're after, what do they say? They can indict even a ham sandwich. This is a real problem. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dr. Stan, and let me again encourage you. We hope many of you will want to come and hear the discussion of the USA Patriot Act and the growth, church growth movement, discussion of Christian persecution. Here, Brad Dacus will be speaking. We're going to have Bill Saudi here talking on health issues. And, of course, I'm going to be there talking on the Supreme Court. And we're also going to be talking about why we're really in Iraq. Well, we've got Mike calling in from Santa Cruz, I assume. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Hi, Stan. I just want to make note of what you guys were saying a few minutes ago about all the money going to Iraq and right. then to the Soviet or the Russians or whoever. For all the Marxists and socialists who are listening in, and I know they're listening, this is what is known as redistribution of the wealth. This is only one actually small example, probably, but that's what it is. This is your program, folks. This is what your philosophy is producing.
Well, I think the significant thing is for people to understand we've subsidized Russia and communism since its inception, creating the best enemy money could buy, and the question is, why are you doing this? It doesn't make sense unless there is another agenda behind everything going on.
Well,
this is not the first time. Yeah. There was a congressman named Larry McDonald who actually had a foundation back in Washington, D.C., and Larry McDonald, the whole thrust was how we financed the Soviet Union since its inception, and he made the mistake of taking Korean Flight 007, which was, of course, shot down over Sakhalin Island. Many people believe that he survived the crash, that everybody survived the crash. There were a few bodies that were found, very, very few. The rest of the bodies were not found, and it's felt that they were probably spirited away someplace. And they're still living over there in some prison camp, and Larry McDonald has been isolated. Why? Because the one thing they could not afford is for the American people to realize the greatest secret of all time, and that is that communism simply was financed from America starting back in 1919, and is still being financed today with your tax money as we give money to Iraq so that they can pay back the loans to Russia. What's wrong with this scenario? Anything else, Mike?
Well, when you say it's financed from America, we could narrow that down and say that it's financed from the Empire State, New York, the capital of which is Manhattan.
Okay, anything else you want to say?
Just back to the Marxists. They've been sold a bill of goods. This is this redistribution is a great, fine founding philosophy to help the world's poor and whoever. But this is really the agenda that was really behind that. It was all a lie. Too many people have bought into it. And so, end of that one.
Right now we're in the process of redistributing the wealth of the American people as we export our industries, as we export our jobs, as we export our wealth to the rest of the world. Let's get John's comment on what you're saying. John, do you have any comment on this?
Yeah, but however, don't expect, when it's greeted with absolute failure, which it's been greeted before, the socialist system, it collapses every time it's tried. Don't ever expect an admission of guilt, fault, or recognition that it really doesn't work. The mouths keep talking. They keep yakking and keep trying it again and again and again and again. I've learned that. I used to think that if you could just sort of reason with these people at some point or another, you could show them and they would go, oh my gosh, you're right, we've been desperately wrong, yada, yada, yada. But that just doesn't happen. Okay.
Well, one by one, maybe it does happen, but it's hard to tell.
Yeah, but that's a good point. One by one, it does happen, but it's hard to tell, and therefore you can't count on it.
I will tell you one thing, Mike, and that is I believe that some people are beginning to wake up much more so than ever before as they begin noticing that there are less and less jobs, and then they say, we've got this wonderful jobless recovery, and the economy is so good. Anybody who looks at the stock market knows that is a totally manipulated stock market.
Yeah.
And this is not a healthy recovery. There is no recovery other than the fact that we're spending, billions and billions of dollars. We're going to have a deficit next year of about $750 billion, three-quarters of $1 trillion. Any country could live pretty well spending money like that, but the day of reckoning comes because you have to pay back the debts that you have. And right now, so much of the money that we are borrowing is coming from other countries. We have to borrow $1.5 billion every day just to meet our deficits here in this country. That's scary.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Well, one more thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
While I've got you on it, we could use maybe a program in the near future on the chemtrails.
We are going to have one next Tuesday evening at 9 o'clock.
Well, that's good, because we've been getting it heavy the last few weeks.
We have, and there's going to be some programs here in Santa Cruz put on by people who are concerned, as you are, and we'll be covering that next Tuesday evening.
Okay, great, thanks.
Hey, thanks so much, and let's go to Ed from Idaho. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Dr. Stan, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you? What part of Idaho are you in?
Post Falls.
Okay.
Hi, John.
Hi there.
Have a question or comment?
Yes, in reference to your last caller, you're not suggesting the government would lie to us, are you, Dr. Stan?
You can that old adage, you can tell how when a politician is lying because his lips are moving. And I hate to say that. I wish that we could really trust the people in government. But the way it's set up, you can't, because they can lie all they want to. If they told the American people the truth, that Medicare and Social Security is bankrupt, what do you think would happen to the politician who told the truth? They wouldn't be angry at the system. They'd be mad at the politician. And
well,
so
it's interesting.
Politicians just sort of go along with the flow. Most of them aren't dedicated to the right or the left. They're just dedicated to staying in Washington, D.C.
What's interesting is if anyone should tell the government something that's not true, they go to prison for fraud or perjury. But yet they lie to us all the time. The reason I called, there was an interesting article that came out today, I think it was on Newsmax. The title is General Franks Doubts Constitution Will Survive WMD Attack.
Yeah, I saw that.
In fact, John just sent that to me, I think.
Yeah.
And I think you're right, and I think that. But the question is, why are they putting that out? Newsmax,
you
must understand, is becoming really a mouthpiece for the administration. I mean, I love Chris Ruddy, but you read that magazine, and it looks like it was put out by the Republican Party.
I think it's an announcement of the current condition.
Right. And I think I'm more frightened not because of what he said, but why it was said and why that is being put out to the American people.
Can I just read a couple sentences?
Go ahead.
Okay. General Tommy Franks says that if the United States is hit with a weapon of mass destruction that inflicts large casualties, the Constitution will likely be discarded in favor of a military form of government. Franks, who successfully led the U.S. military operation to liberate Iraq, expressed his worries in an extensive interview he gave to the men's lifestyle magazine Cigar Aficionado. In the magazine's December edition, the former commander of the military central command warned that if terrorists succeed in using a weapon of mass destruction against the U.S. or one of our allies, it would likely have catastrophic consequences for our cherished Republican form of government. That's an announcement of fact.
John, what's your take on that?
Well, the interesting question that I would ask is why would suddenly the whole government have to be replaced? I mean, that doesn't flow naturally. You see what I'm saying? He was talking about a total replacement with a military government. Now, the only thing that would cause that is a total breakdown in the country. I mean, a total breakdown where typically when you get to that kind of chaos, somebody has to impose order from the top down.
Have you read the Bremer report? It's called The Current Terrorist Threat. It was published about the year 2000 and published by a man named Paul Bremer, who today is the dictator in Iraq.
Right.
And in this report, and you can pull this down off the internet, it starts out with a long, about three or four paragraphs, talking about Pearl Harbor. Now, why are they talking about Pearl Harbor, you know, in the year 2000, a year before the 9/11 attack? And the basic theme is, gee, Pearl Harbor occurred because just the government is so inefficient, and one department didn't know what was another was doing, and it was just a total collapse of communication. That's why we had Pearl Harbor, and I know that's a lie because I actually have a copy of the pages from Secretary of War Stimson's diary in November 25th, 1941, where he talks about going to the White House with General George Catlett Marshall and Admiral Stark and Secretary of the Navy Knox, and I've forgotten who the other person, the president was there. And the president said, we're going to be attacked probably on Monday. They always attack by surprise. And the only question is how we're going to get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot. and have as little damage to ourselves as possible. I have that. I'll be glad to send the pages from the diary to anybody out there. They knew the attack was coming. They let it occur. They needed an excuse to get us into the war. Now, here Paul Bremer writing then in the year 2000, using that as the background saying, and what that report in essence says is, when we have a major terrorist attack, the military are going to take over the United States. It's called the current terrorist threat. If you do have a computer, you can find it on the internet. If not, of course, we can provide it for you. We'd have to charge you for it, because we have them all bound and nicely. But the plan is there, but they don't want the American people to know. So you're right, John, they wouldn't have to impose the military rule, but I think there are people who'd love to have military rule in what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Yeah, I wonder how well that would fly.
Well, I think the American people, if there's a problem, will look to government, because most people have forgotten what our founding father said about, you know, government is not eloquence, government is not reason, it's force, like fire, it's a dangerous servant, but a fearful master. They've forgotten that government governs best, that governs the least, or the secret of America, that was the limitation on the power of our government. I think the American people, in face with a major catastrophe, would look to government for help, just like we look to the government to help if there's a tornado or a major earthquake. The only trouble is, when the terrorist incident is over, why, freedom will not be restored. You have anything else you want to say, Ed?
Order out of chaos.
Order out of chaos. I think that comes out of the masonry, doesn't it? Anything
yes,
else, John?
No.
Before we let Ed go? But I think that's a very important article, and I appreciate you mentioning it, Ed.
Thank you.
Your job, your assignment up there, is to get as many people as you can listening to our program, going to our website at radioliberty.com, and they can listen to our programs 5 hours a day. And then, of course, tell them to go to steelonsteel.com and listen to John's commentary. Or our Saturday program will be my interview with John that we did this morning, which I think was outstanding, talking about the threat of globalization that is being, of course, used as a vehicle to impoverish the American people.
Dr. Stan?
Yes.
One last quote, if I might.
Sure.
A constitution of government, once changed from freedom, can never be restored. Liberty, once lost, is lost forever. John Adams.
I think you're absolutely right. And remember, of course, that the President Clinton put into law something called PDD 60, which said, if we are to be attacked by incoming missiles, we will absorb the attack. We will not retaliate until after we've been attacked. He didn't add, we may not have anything to retaliate with. But, I mean, this was the most absurd thing, and yet George W. Bush, has kept PDD 60 in place.
You'll know them by their fruits.
Thanks so very much.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, John, you know, there's so many things going on today, and yet, you know, it's so easy to get discouraged and despondent, and yet these are exciting times, because we know the Lord has a hand in this. Yes, there is a battle, and I believe that many of the people in positions of government, whether they know it or not, are energized by the forces of darkness and have embraced their agenda, and they've turned their back on God. On the other hand, God is still there, and hopefully he will look after those of us who are true to him. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I tend to think that's what I started out by saying in the program, is that you have to begin with that, because you can get really... I mean, I saw that article today, and I thought, well, now, why is he saying this, you know? And it was like a harbinger of things to come. But still people have to live, and they, you know, life goes on in the midst of that. And people need to understand what is happening and then what that means as far as how they live. And God does take care of us.
And, you know, many times people say, what can I do? And I say, well, our job is to do our best. But after we've done our best, the results are up to the Lord. The results are not up to me. If I tell people what's going on and they ignore what I say, that's their problem. That's not mine.
Right. I mean, that's all I do on my program anyway, is basically I just go, well, here's what's going on. We spend our time researching it. You know, it's really hard to do this, too. I don't think people appreciate that, because you have to sift. You're trying to figure out what's happening. You would start by assuming that what you hear for public consumption is just wrong, de facto, that it's desire to steer the public to a predetermined outcome, whether it's financially or politically, etc. then you have to figure out what is truth from fiction, because there is a lot of disinformation out there. If you've done all of that, then you have to try to tell people and say this is sort of it. And what's really funny is, despite the fact that you may have an excellent track record, most people don't remember that. You know, they don't remember what you said 10 years ago when you were pointing towards certain things. Very few people remember the fact that we were pretty right on when we talked about where the direction of education was going and stuff like that. And
you were even talking about Osama bin Laden a couple of years before the 9/11.
Yeah, we started talking about Osama bin Laden in 96, as a matter of fact. You know, so, and we were talking about the coming Islamic terrorism. We started into biological warfare in somewhere around 97, 98. Because we were concerned, we understood that it was the increasing... You know, this was there for anybody to see. This is the funny part. It was there for... And the intelligence people were talking about it. I was talking about it. I remember my daughter in her speech class. Everybody else was doing... This was in first year of college, and everybody else was doing presentations on global warming. She comes in and does this whole presentation on biological warfare. Now, this is before anybody had thought about it. And you can, I saw the videotape of everybody sitting there in the class with their, you know, their eyes bulging out, their mouths hanging open as she goes through this whole presentation of showing them how you could carry anthrax around and this and that. She's a biology major. So we knew about it, you know. I couldn't figure out why on the day of 9/11 I felt so strange. It took me all day to figure it out. And that was, I wasn't shocked by what happened on 9/11. We knew it was coming. John O'Neill knew it was coming. On 9/11. I mean, he didn't know that it was 9/11 necessarily, but he knew it was coming for the World Trade Center. The only thing I was grieved, like everybody else, and the loss of life was sickening, but I just wasn't shocked. And that's why when everybody else was running around going, oh, we're shocked, who could have imagined that, you know, can you imagine? Well, yeah, I imagined it. Only the problem now is, Dr. Stan, based on what I'm reading, I'm imagining a lot worse. And I'm predicting we have to have two galvanizing events to make this thing really fly. We have to have a galvanizing, probably maybe three even, a galvanizing event in this country. Now, 9/11 was not Pearl Harbor. I'm sorry. The whole country just is not moving and united in that way. So if I were to say, what are we going to have to do to make this happen? If I were a globalist, if I were thinking that, we would have to allow something worse to happen to galvanize it. The second thing has to galvanize the Islamic world. Well, there's a general trend in the Islamic world. The Islamic world is still too divided over too many issues. And the third one is, Europe, I think, will probably have its own 9/11. The interesting part is that the dialectical method of thought is literally a form of mental morphine. And even in this country, we're having trouble fighting it. But in Europe, they can't even figure out who the enemies are and why. And so in this country here, say, for example, in the city of New York, we won't allow people to do things for Christmas, but we'll allow things for Ramadan or you know, other holidays.
Kwanzaa, and don't forget Kwanzaa.
And Kwanzaa and all of these other things. And I'm thinking, we've lost the ability to see clearly black from white, white from black, and to understand what the issue is. You know, Avi Lipkin was here this week, and I was talking to him again, his wife being Egyptian, and he said, you know, Americans just don't understand the Islamic mindset. We are so obsessed with political correctness that we fail to understand you're in a conflict of worldviews here, and of course that conflict is being used for purposes that I don't think even the Muslims anticipate. Because we knew that ultimately three religious groups were going to have to go to make this whole global socialism work. Quranic Islam, Orthodox Judaism, and Biblical Christianity. And that would include what I would call Orthodox and Roman Catholics. That all has to go.
In fact, we even have a website that with Gorbachev and Marie Strong. And when they put this, originally up, it was on the Earth Charter, but there on page 10 of that, they said we are going to have to eliminate the monotheistic religions, Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Now, they did take that down, though we have a copy of the original, and we'll make that available to one of our listeners. They don't want them to know, the people to know that this is what they really intend. And yet, if you go back and you read the Global Biodiversity Assessment that came out in following the Second Earth Summit in 1992, they said essentially the same thing. The real enemies are the monotheistic religion, the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews. So they're going to get us to kill the Muslims, and then, of course, they'll finish off the Christians and Jews. And you say, that could never happen. And I would ask you, why couldn't that happen? Because we're dealing, as you started out the program, with truly demonic forces.
Truly demonic forces, and we're dealing in the midst of a great paradigm change. And I pointed out in a speech I gave this week in Spokane that out of 14,000 pastors in Germany at the time Hitler came to power, and we're talking about Protestant pastors, only about 4,000 refused to join the German Christian Church, which was nothing more than Nazi theology with a Christian-looking patina thrown on the top of it. Out of that 4,000, probably only a handful stood up and took the heat for opposing the whole thing. Remember the confessing church. My question was, and even after the war, they were all scratching their heads trying to figure out what had happened. Well, apparently, because of worldview issues and whatever, only a few people in every generation see what is really coming on. There were a number of people, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who just called it right on the head, right from the start with. The same thing for Bishop Sheen here in this thing that I read. The same thing for Francis Schaeffer, 30 years after Bishop Sheen was saying the same thing. And they've called it very accurately, the direction we've gone in. The strange part for me that I always sit and scratch my head about, and there's plenty of room to do that now since I don't have any hair, is why the church itself doesn't seem to pick up on these. The church is preoccupied with all sorts of stuff that has little bearing on anything. Pastors assume if they flock people through the front door and push people through the programs or whatever, they've done their work and served the kingdom of heaven. And I said, well, maybe so, but maybe you haven't even started the work of the kingdom of heaven. Because the purpose of the church is to train warriors, which is why, say, for example, John Eldridge's Wild at Heart program is kicking off so much. And I don't want to go down that rabbit trail, though. But the point is, people have suddenly understood that going to church to become a nice guy just isn't the core of the whole thing. We're here to fight a battle. Paul understood this. Paul was a warrior of theology, so to speak. And that mentality is totally lost. You would waste incredible amounts of energy in any church trying to turn it around and alert them to what was happening. And I've always wondered why this phenomenon is true. It was true of the church, many of the churches behind the Soviet bloc before the Soviets took over. It was true in Germany. It's turning out to be true in the West as well. And I can't quite figure that out why. They seem to have lost their way.
Well, I really believe that they have infiltrated the seminaries many years ago. And a lot of our ministers, a lot of them really aren't sure that the scriptures are actually accurate. I mean, Christianity is a wonderful religion, to love your neighbor. But then, of course, you could love your neighbor whether you're a Christian or not. But what they've done is they've taken away the real belief that God is not only a God of love, but he's a God of justice and judgment. And there is punishment for sin, and we are all sinners. And increasingly, our churches don't want to talk about that sort of thing. They certainly would never want to mention hell. After all, a loving God would never send people to hell, to eternal punishment, just because they did a few little sins here and there. We've changed the very nature of God, and until we get back to what the Bible really preaches and realize it's the same God in the Old Testament as the New Testament, why, I don't think anything's going to change. Remember what Jonathan Edwards talked about when he did this talk for the Great Awakening back in 1740? A sinner in the hands of an angry God. And men trembled, their hearts fainted, but they turned to God. And we need something like that right now. And maybe that's what we've been called to do, is to point out what's going on. And maybe that's all we're to do, and then, of course, hope God will use our effort to bring people to a realization of what's really happening and where their strength really is.
Well, it could be that. I know historically people don't get back, quote-unquote, to where they came from. Typically what happens is small faithful groups band together as the rest fall away. That's been the pattern. And we're following that pattern again. I always remember, I think was it J. Vernon McGee, before he died, said that the greatest persecution from the church would come from the official churches, ultimately, in this country, and nobody sort of believed him at the time. But I think Barrett Chose has been saying as much as well.
Well, I think we need a third great awakening. Without a third great awakening, I fear for the survival of this nation.
Yeah, I tend to believe that. It's like it was that whole thing about, you know, the Constitution won't survive another attack. Why not? Who's going to rip it down? You don't need to rip it down to deal with a crisis.
Well, I think Jay Leno said it best. He said, you know, we're working to actually have a new constitution, to write a new constitution over in Iraq. Why don't we just send them ours? Because we're not using it
we're
anymore.
We're not using it anymore,
we're
right.
We're not using it anymore. And everybody laughed.
We basically bludgeoned it to death. You know, the funny part is the liberals are all upset. I'm going to write an editorial, but it was the liberal Congress for 30 years that set the stage, that bludgeoned the Constitution into the ground, that then set the stage for what the neocons have done.
Amen to that. We're out of time. John, thanks so much for coming on with me. It's always a pleasure having you here at Radio Liberty.
Appreciate it.
Good night. God bless. And this is Dr. Stan saying, pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for that third great awakening, that revival that really is the only hope for America. And lastly, please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until Monday, may the Lord be with you.